Hi, good afternoon, Chair. I'm Kimmy Makwetu, Auditor General.
Good afternoon, members. Gavin van der Hoeven from the Auditor General.
Thank you. Over to you, MG.
Thank you very much, Chair, and once again, greetings to all members present. Chair, when I heard that this meeting was planned for an hour, I went ahead and committed myself to a 2 o'clock meeting. So we decided that let me start with the PAA amendments as part of the early part of the meeting. I think if I'm lucky, it will probably take me no more than 20, 25 minutes, and then the colleagues from the local audit office will deal with the rest, possibly while I'm still here, but I'm asking that I be excused just before 2 o'clock to attend to the other meeting, if acceptable to you, Chair. Let me kick off. As I start, I am moving from the premise that the matter of the amendments to the Public Audit Act is now a known reality, which process started some 2 years ago when we presented our audit results for the 2017 financial year. Chair, there was a big outcry when those audit outcomes were presented, to the extent that our former chair of the Standing Committee on the AG at that briefing session suggested that something needs to be done to the regulatory instrument in order to make sure that some level of power is given to the Auditor General. Now, in going through this presentation, Chairs, I will try my best to demonstrate what this power that has been articulated in the Public Audit Act is about from our point of view. But while I do that, and maybe for the benefit of the members, we have distributed some booklets which reflect the new act as amended. You will find the specific sections of our amendment between page 15 and page 19 of that small booklet. Everything that has been amended is contained in those pages. Everything else outside of those pages is, as you would have known, the law as it stood prior to its coming into effect. I think what is important, perhaps, at a starting point on page 5 of the slide presentation, is to deal with what has been the new introduction to the Public Audit Act as amended. On the slide, on the board, as well as on your page, I think it must be page 10 of the slide presentation, we have a slide which says what is a material irregularity. It's page 5 here, but I think the slide itself is page 10. Now, if anybody were to ask what is it that has assumed central focus as far as the amendments of the Public Audit Act are concerned, my answer would be it is the introduction of the concept of a material irregularity. That's effectively what has come into these amendments. And I say this because in the Public Audit Act before, there was never any reference to auditors having to assume responsibility for material irregularities specifically. What we've often been asked to focus on in our audits was to report on the outcomes of the audit, but also to highlight those specific matters in the audit that require the attention of people charged with oversight. But as members will also remember, as we were reporting over these last 20 years on matters like irregular expenditure, fraudulent and wasteful expenditure, and unauthorized expenditure, and other types of deviations from what is expected in terms of accountability, we would be engaged in different fora about the real meaning of irregular expenditure. And so it took a long time for people to settle in their minds that an irregular expenditure is not a philosophical term. It is something that points to the manner in which expenditure has not been properly handled. Then we'll be entangled in a conversation about whether it is or it is not corruption, because some people will say they've delivered services and therefore they don't believe that there's anything wrong they did. Now, the elevation of a material irregularity in the context of that debate was to try and make it clear and make it simpler for everybody to understand exactly what it is that the auditors will be looking at once this material irregularity concept has been introduced. So as you can see on the slide, we have basically taken the definition of a material irregularity as we have crafted it, leading to the adoption of the Public Audit Amendment Act. And in essence, a material irregularity means any non-compliance with or contravention of legislation, fraud, theft, or a breach of a fiduciary duty, which has been identified during an audit performed under the Public Audit Act that resulted in or is likely to result in a material financial loss, the misuse or loss of a material public resource, or substantial harm to a public sector institution or the general public. Now, this definition has been framed to be as broad as it is, so that when auditors are reflecting on the work that they are doing in an audit, they also have to have an appreciation that there's an expectation for them to look a lot deeper than they used to before. You'll recall that even with private sector auditors, they often argue that an audit is not an investigation. An audit is not structured to pick up issues of fraud, theft, or corruption. They often say that an audit is about reporting on fair presentation of financial statements. Now, in our case, the Public Audit Act still requires us to issue an audit opinion on the fair presentation of the financial statements, which means that we are expected to audit the accounts of any entity with a view to giving a conclusion that they have been transparent in the manner in which they have reported on their activities, they have disclosed all material transactions that are pertinent to the appreciation of the activities as well as the financial standing of that entity. But this additional consideration of a material irregularity is an instruction almost by the legislator to the auditors to say well and good that we are going to come up with that conclusion which meets international standards on auditing. But if you bring it closer home, we would like you as an Auditor General to pay specific attention to the concept of a material irregularity. Let's just bring a practical example to this, just to broaden the appreciation of what it means. When we reported on the local government audit outcomes around the end of June, in the media release that we made out, we drew attention, for example, to one municipality in the Free State where we had a total expenditure in that municipality of about 21.7 million on a project to deliver sports and recreation facility in that community. So the auditors vouched for this transaction, and I think as I'm speaking, I'm sure you will appreciate where the definition is leading us to, which is something in the past we did not really have to worry about to the greatest extent. Now, having spent the 21.7 million and agreed it to the accounting records, we then wanted to go and see this facility so that we can for ourselves independently compare the total amount spent versus what we see. And what we saw was a mere field fenced. And that's what this new concept of a material irregularity is leading to. It says, look for non-compliance, and there's no doubt that in spending 21.7 million, there's a litany of non-compliances that have happened in order to deliver just a fence, in essence. Contravention of legislation, no doubt about it. Fraud or theft, the suspicion is very high, in the sense that you've got a huge amount of expenditure against what auditors have physically seen, which is just a mere fence covering that area where potentially this sports and recreation facility was meant to be built. So another example again that we highlighted in another province, I think it was in the northwest, with the upgrade and upgrade of a road network, where on the basis of the work that was done on the audit, the auditors determined that the expenditure was for about, I think, 8 kilometers of road. But as they physically verified this distance that was covered by this upgrade and enhancement of this road, they could only vouch for 3 kilometers. So these are the things that a material irregularity is going to help put the spotlight on, because it's no longer a case of an irregular expenditure where you've deviated from rules, but it is going to go right into the transaction in situations where the auditors have identified the risk. So that is what that slide is about. Now, having introduced the concept of material irregularity, what must then happen? And I'm now on slide number 9. The public audit act has introduced, as you will see, the narrative on page 15 to 19, 3 specific steps that the auditors need to perform once a material irregularity has been identified. First of all, it may happen that what has been delivered is probably more complex, technically speaking, for auditors to have a full appreciation of what has happened, what is the extent of possible abuse. And it may be something that is really, really complex. It might well mean, for example, those big concretes that you see in places like Kusile. They were not delivered by a truck. They were built over a number of years, many of them. And there may be many technical complications that auditors must get around to be able to understand exactly what the relationship between what has been built or bought versus the amount spent. Hence, the expanded mandate is then giving us the power to refer any suspected or identified material irregularity during the course of an audit to a public body that has got the requisite mandate to perform such investigations. And you will know that many of these bodies fall under the category of ACTT, which is the Anti-Corruption Task Team, including the likes of the Public Protector, which will be the kind of bodies that if we found something that is potentially going to require a lot more time, because an audit normally happens within 2 months after the financial year end, which means that there may not be enough time to get to the bottom of some of these issues. Hence the power to do a referral officially and formally to another agency that has been assessed to have the requisite competency to carry out that particular investigation. Then, again, once that particular agency has completed its investigation and we have done our work as well in terms of the audit, we will be required, once we've picked up a material irregularity, to report on it in the audit report of the entity. Currently, the deviations that we pick up from the standard rules and procedures are normally reported in the management report. Now, a management report is normally a document between management and the auditors, which is designed to track clearance of audit recommendations where internal controls have broken down. But a material irregularity has been elevated to a very significant breakdown in the system of internal control. And so it is no longer going to be reported as a material irregularity in the management report. It will now find place in the audit report. Now, why is this a significant development? It is significant because an audit report goes together with the financial statements. And both the audit report and the financial statements are included in the annual report of an entity. And every entity, including municipalities, are required through the PFMA and the MFMA to table their annual reports in the legislatures. So which means it's no longer just an exchange of these significant control weaknesses between management and the auditors and never find the light of day. As soon as we have concluded that it is a material irregularity, there will be a section in the audit report which will go together with an annual report that is specifically tabled that canvasses the matter that has been identified. Let's make an example with the earlier example I made. I could have a heading in the audit report of this municipality saying, we have identified total expenditure of 21.7 million in respect of a planned implementation of a sports and recreation facility in the financial year. Our evidence suggests that the correlation between the amount spent as well as what was delivered is definitely not in place, and therefore we believe that a material irregularity has happened, and we have brought this material irregularity to the attention of the accounting officer. So that is potentially what we would do by the time we issue the audit report. And so once we've identified a material irregularity, the Public Audit Amendment Act requires us, through the regulations that have been issued, to hand over during the course of the audit that material irregularity, known or suspected, to the accounting officer. Why the accounting officer? Because the accounting officer is the highest level of accountability in managing and overseeing the administrative systems of any publicly funded entity. So by handing it over to the accounting officer is being given up to 20 working days while they're busy in the audit to fix that identified material irregularity. To fix it will go a number of ways. They must know, because they have been entrusted with the highest level of accountability to look after these resources. So when we bring it to the attention of the accounting officer that we have identified a material irregularity, they know that they must act within 20 days, either to recover the loss or to stop the loss from continuing, or take any other appropriate action that they believe as an accounting officer is necessary in order to deal with the identified material irregularity. And the reason we are pointing this, and the Amendment Act is quite clear as well, because Section 38 of the PFMA is very clear about the roles and duties of an accounting officer. And Section 39 of the PFMA also prescribes what must happen in terms of an accounting officer that is not acting in accordance with the PFMA. And further on, there are certain consequences also built into the PFMA that need to be activated when a material irregularity is identified through an accounting officer. The same happens with municipalities through the MFMA, where Section 62 to Section 65 has got very specific roles and responsibilities of an accounting officer, as well as the consequence that follows if a financial misconduct has been identified. Now, once we've handed it over and we identify that the accounting officer within that 20 days has not satisfactorily responded to the auditors, we are then required to issue that recommendation in the audit report as to what it is that we've recommended the accounting officer to do. The accounting officer will be given a specific number of days from the date that the recommendation is issued. And by the way, the recommendation is like our recommendations as they are now. They are an arrangement between the accounting officer and the auditors to restore internal controls in the environment. So they are not enforceable. But if the accounting officer has been given, for example, 30 days, again staying with this example, and the 30 days expires without having put in place a sustainable solution to prevent the continuing financial loss, then if you see what is on page 9, that recommendation then becomes a binding remedial action. So it almost becomes an instruction to the accounting officer to now say, you shall implement steps A, B, C, and D in respect of the identified material irregularity. So there's no longer a case of, well, give me a chance, this, that, and the other. If you say that it takes 10 days, in our view, after we've given you the 20 days during the audit, and we've also given you a number of weeks when the recommendation was finalized, maybe you can claim that you were not around and this happened when you were not there. That is what we are trying to do by giving you the opportunity as an accounting officer to really interact with whoever may have triggered a transaction like that, and without you knowing. We'll just give you the benefit of doubt in case you didn't. And then once it becomes a binding remedial action, and you still have a number of days within which to implement the binding remedial action, and you don't, then the binding remedial action also expires, and we are now in the territory of issuing a death certificate. So when all of this is planned out and is mapped out properly, we should not get to the following financial year before we have covered all three steps. Because the accounts are signed off in July for the departments and entities. Let's say we give you another month or so. Clearly, by the end of November, in that same year, we should have covered the bulk of what is expected in terms of these amendments, right up to consideration for issuing a certificate of debt in the name of an accounting officer or individual members of an accounting authority. Members of the board, because they also in the same act have got specific responsibilities that are articulated for what their role is as oversight of that entity in making sure that accountability is effected. And there are a number of considerations also here that have been built in our regulations to make sure that natural justice is also achieved. There will be no way in which a certificate of debt is issued to an accounting officer before there has been engagement with the accounting officer. And of course, the engagement would have started at the point of identification of the material irregularity. So it's unlikely that we can reach this stage with an accounting officer that does not know where this thing comes from. However, on top of that, we've also set aside a process whereby independent persons will receive representations from an accounting officer if an accounting officer believes there are matters of dispute that need to be cleared ahead of a certificate of debt being issued. So in essence, these steps, honorable members, are meant to activate the existing provisions that are there in the PFMA and the MFMA so that we don't sit with glaring material irregularities for 5 to 10 years without anybody taking ownership of them. Because most of the time you discover that they have moved between functions when 5 to 10 years has lapsed, whereas the regulations have also been developed in a way whereby if you are still an accounting officer and the conversation about the binding remedial action was still happening with you, then the final conclusion of that matter will follow you wherever you are in respect of getting to take accountability for the remedial action or the issuing of a certificate of debt. So if you've moved from Department A when the conversation about the remedial action was already in progress and you decide to go to Department C, then all the processes that will follow after that particular moment of the remedial action will be around you as the accounting officer who was in office at the time when these sections were required to be activated. And then the rest of what I have in the presentation perhaps is to deal with the implementation, and I'm now on slide number 13. Because the Act was approved early this year, I think somewhere around February, March, and we got a confirmation through the Government Gazette that the President has assented to the Act for effective date 1 April 2019. So what we did then in looking at the implementation implications for the 18-19 audit was to develop some criteria for selecting some auditees with whom we are going to start in testing some of these amendments. And it's clear to us that most laws, once they are amended or brought about, it often takes sometimes more than a year before you can hit the implementation. But at least in our case, we decided that because we've got a universe of auditees whose history we know, as well as whose history of audit outcomes we have, as well as criteria like those that have had high irregular expenditure over a period of time, we then decided to select out of the population of auditees for the PFMA about 16. And the idea was also to have broad coverage across portfolios. So we've had 16 that were included in this cycle. The cycle that we reported on in July, we had 16 where we started activating some of these. Because it got in late in the process and it's a new process and a new procedure, our staff was, you know, were also meant to figure it out how this thing will work, because it's a very new procedure which has got a lot of hooks in it. But I'm happy to say that that initial 16 that we took on has triggered up to now somewhere close to 60 material irregularities specifically identified during the 2019 audit. Now you can imagine if you had the entire population of auditees in year one, for argument's sake, if it was practical, you can almost extrapolate how many material irregularities could there be. If you take into account the fact that we did not have a shortage of irregular expenditures across all of them. Now, if we are looking at material irregularities, we're sure that there will be quite a lot that would have been in the net. So that was for the PFMA. The MFMA is a junior end. The accounts for the MFMA for municipality are due end of this week. It's normally 2 weeks, 2 months after the financial year end. So all our teams will be receiving financial statements from municipalities at the end of this week, which are due for audit. And for municipalities, we have selected 9, meaning we've got a municipality in each of the provinces that will be selected. Also based on these criteria, which are on page 13, so those 9 predominantly, you will find a lot of the metros included in that 9. There will be local municipalities, but there's quite a number of metros as we have them. So we'll wait and see when we report at the end of November to what extent there's a concentration of material irregularities among those 9 municipalities. And the idea is to take all this feedback back to our teams to address some of the complexities in terms of the technical interpretation, issues of pushback, which we have experienced again this time around, and many others, to make sure that we incorporate them in the procedures that we are going to put in place come the 2020 financial year end. So once we've done the analysis, it is possible that 2020 will be the year that we widen the net with regards to all of the auditees who will be subject to these new amendments. But I'm saying this ahead of doing the assessment, because this was more to say, let's just start with a manageable population of auditees, because some of these things can be tricky. You cannot easily determine financial loss in some situations. Financial loss is not the fact that I should have bought it for 5 rands, but I bought it for 25. How do we know? We don't have the data in place to be able to come to that conclusion. So there are those complexities, but there are certain things that are low-hanging fruit. Fence versus 21.7 million, please explain. Doesn't matter whether we have the prices in respect of how much recreation facility is. So there is a lot of risk intelligence and risk management that will be part of what we look at in terms of this over a period of time. And so if I may just leave it at that point, honorable members, and say that perhaps for us, the real objective for this is really not to get involved in anybody's arrest. Other people do that. But we would want to hand over this certificate of debt ultimately to an executive authority who will then trigger the necessary processes internally as to how to effect the requirement. Because we were discouraged, and in fact we also did not want to get involved with recovery of other people's debts. All we do is really just to flag and to highlight it so that it can have prominence of place among those that are exercising oversight, so that we don't get a cumulative effect of these things after 10, 15 years, and then we find ourselves not even knowing who was in charge of the books at the time. So I've used one example, and perhaps there are a couple of other examples that might give you a sense in terms of this. A few years ago, when we were receiving the accounts of one municipality in the Eastern Cape, we came across what is called a miscellaneous account in their books. Now, a miscellaneous account and anything that is spent by anybody will always be a debit in that person's books, because the credit is what goes out of bank. To reduce bank, you credit bank and you debit this other account, whatever you want to call it. So the minute you call it a miscellaneous account, it almost triggers that risk response in our heads to say something miscellaneous is probably a combination of things that are not clearly identifiable. What could they be? And here was an amount of about 60 odd million in this account accumulated over the year, and the entity was wanting to report it as a sundry debtor, meaning that it is owed to them by some person. Now, this is a balance sheet account, and that's why it will find its way into a sundry debtor. And then we ask for a reconciliation of the accounting record and for the analysis of the account, only to discover that a lot of these amounts that were sitting on the debit were supposed to go through the income statement because they are costs for the current period. They are not assets of the entity. So you needed to credit this miscellaneous account and debit the right income statement account in order for people to be able to compare the budget that they approved against what you spent. But funny enough, in this account, there were other transactions like 2,500,000 exactly. And in some instances, you will find a transaction for 400,000 exactly. In some cases, those kind of transactions with zeros only. Now, the kind of things that we buy are normally quantity times price. And it's not always 500 things times 20 rand. There will always be a situation, including the 14% VAT that was applicable at the time, which will give you an amount of 179,342.27 for argument's sake. Now, when you've got an amount like that in a miscellaneous account and you're an auditor with a forensic insight, you will know that these types of transactions were possibly somebody paying something that they probably would not want anybody to ask them questions about, kind of stuff. Now, this elevation of a material irregularity will get us there, because we are going to ask for the account reconciliations through the accounting officer, and if the accounting officer is not able to produce account reconciliations, then the discussion will take us much closer to some of those transactions which are normally unusual. It doesn't mean that you cannot make a payment to somebody for 2,500,000, but the minute there are multiples of them, because we know that also the information technology environment in some places is very weak. People use their date of birth, they use their children's names for passwords. So it's easy to guess some of the passwords and go into somebody who is responsible for electronic funds transfer, set up a payment under ABC PTY using your bank account, when you know that this is going to lend itself to a miscellaneous account that never gets reconciled, you might just get away with it forever. So these are some of the risk issues that have emerged in terms of our experience in the last cycle, as well as what we think this amended public audit act will assist us to get closer to. Let me pause at that point, Chair, and hopefully there will be some reflection and questions to deal with.
Thank you very much. Very interesting amendment. Material irregularities. It looks like we're getting to the areas where we are able to get. We are in the right direction. I'm going to allow members to speak to the presentation. I've noted the honorable team. Who else? Honorable Sheikh, Honorable Lesoma, Honorable Stenazen. In that order, you can start.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the Auditor General will know me well from my days at Scopa, and know that I'm very supportive. And I hope you can set me right, Chair. I'm just concerned that this doesn't really change much because effectively you can refer a department or an entity if you detect material irregularity, but you used to make those recommendations before to departments to take action. So if a department doesn't do anything, and you yourself said to Mr. McQuitty, you don't want to get involved in arresting people. So when the relevant authorities don't arrest people, don't take action, are you not back to square one? And I'm really not trying to be a killjoy here. I'm just asking a simple question. And then secondly, issuing a debt certificate. You once again said you don't want to get involved in recovering money. So if the person that's death certificate is issued in favour of, I can only imagine it's in favour of someone, then where do we go with actually recovering the funds? And will we not be left in a position, unless we take definitive action from the AG side, left in the same place? And then my final question was, in the definition of, and this is putting the lawyer cap on now, it's very wide in terms of the, I'm assuming there are three elements here, that all three must be satisfied for it to be a material irregularity. And then the first one is extremely wide, so any non-compliance. And then material loss. I know you said you'll just look at the big stuff. That's obviously material. But has there been any interpretation anywhere, any legal advice gained on what material is? Because I can see lawyers coming along and saying, hang on, this isn't material. How do you define material? Are we going to have to wait for precedent for that in our courts to determine what material is? Because unless it's defined somehow, it's going to float. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that presentation. What I wanted to know, in terms of before you provide the death certificate, is there going to be a process, an inquiry, an independent process in whatever structure that is responsible for this material irregularity? Now, because clearly it's got to obviously be an independent exercise or an inquiry that needs to take place. So if you could just lead us to that. Is it a norm and accepted that when it's auditing companies, in giving an audit opinion or report, will go and check on every item or every contract or every aspect of it, or will they just do spot checks? So what happens in those that they don't? That's the other thing. I'm disappointed that the other issue, and I think this is what touches on us more than anything, is the estimation of about 200 billion rand a year that is lost in South Africa as a result of not getting value for money. And I think the AG has spoken about that the item is 5 rand and you're paying 25 rand. But my understanding is, with supply chain, with the central procurement office being put and the standardizing of prices, would we at some stage be able to address that? Because that is where a very great percentage of our money is being wasted in that office. Thank you.
Afternoon, Honourable Chair. May I first register my apology, if I may, that with all the experience from the last time, I went to the wrong venue. I went to E26
Arasite.
Father, you can't say that to me. Anyway, but having said that, Chair, it's my humble apology, but also I know that in the previous meetings, my apology was registered that I lost my brother last month, so I really have to catch up. Having said that, it's a continuous apology that I've got a 2 o'clock meeting, that for whatever things that I have that I need to attend, I'll come back, though. So I'll just hand over to somebody to chair the meeting and come back to this committee, because I do have an interest, and it's a very exciting committee, a very powerful one. Having said that, what I've heard in the presentation, I think one is excited. But my question will be then, Chair, that the around the site, slide 14 when I walked in, is that on what legal basis then the responsible or the presiding officer held the person that is responsible for the unit or the department to implement the remedial action, and what then that person individual gets responsible for, legally speaking, so to speak, if the person gets redeployed somewhere, looking for a better way, of course, but also pass on as it will. And also the second question would be also that what informs the auditors to select the auditees, as borrowed from your ways, that you use? What informs that you select and helicopter sort of a selective auditees? Three, Chair. Probably this one is a comment that I love that that we have now started also to unpack the malicious and the malignant specific as it were in terms of the line activities, financial activities as it were. Because like borrowing from local government experience that we'll have officials say that this is plants and equipment, but we'll never know which plants from somebody who is not well confident with the plant and equipment in terms of public service or government as it were, would be better plants where you plant trees. But what else is the tools to execute your responsibility, like your cars, your computers, and so forth and so forth. So I'm saying that one, I think I'm very comfortable and very excited that we are going to unpack that space of budgeting as it were and expenditure. Even going further also, I'm not too sure on this one, too, if there are service providers that are also, because also the other issue that is a priority for our current government is 30 days payment of service providers as it were. Whether do you also look at whether is this a core mandate or is by the way mandate that can be outsourced? That would be my question. Yeah, no, I think the determination of the material and non-material one, I'm comfortable with that. Other than that, I'm very excited to be part of this committee and also listening to the presentation, the better half of the presentation as it were. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Honourable...
Thank you, and bearing in mind that the AG's got to leave at 2, so I'm going to try and keep it short. I've also got an appointment that I've set up just after 2 because the meeting was only scheduled for an hour. I just want to make a comment to start off and say thank you, AG, for the presentation. But, you know, I think we're very good, and I think the Public Order Act, world-class piece of legislation. I think that MFMA, world-class piece of legislation. PFMA, world-class piece of legislation. And the Auditor General's Office that is the envy of many in internationally, and who does the job. But I think that we can't expect the Auditor General to be, you know, the auditor, the policeman, the prosecutor, and the judge. And that's where the system falls down. And that's what worries me, is that, you know, yes, we have material irregularities now. What happens in so many of these instances is when they do get reported to the executive authority, the relevant executive, the SIU, the Hawks, the SAPS, the Commercial Crimes Unit, these things just disappear and we never hear from them again. So I'm not sure what the genesis and what the conclusion is on the fencing issue. But if you look at some of the recent revelations that have come to light around serious irregularity with government procurement, these are things that have been around for 20 years. Some of these cases go back 10, 15 years with no consequence for the individuals involved. And the longer that there are no consequences, the more of a network and framework you create for this type of behavior to continue. And so, you know, I think we must expect too much from the AG. He's got a job to do, and that is to, and you know, reveal. But then it's over to institutions like this Parliament to actually, you know, grapple with and deal with those findings and to deal with them in a manner which actually results in people being held accountable. So that municipality, for instance, with that fencing there, should be called before the portfolio committee, come to the portfolio committee, and made to account for it. It can't just be that it's one day of bad headlines for the municipality and the next year the Audit Chair goes back, and it's not a sports field this time, it's a combi course or something like that, where the misdirection or misappropriation has happened. So, you know, I think that I want to appreciate the work that the AG does, but I think the problem that we have in South Africa doesn't lie in the revealing of it, which is important. It relies on the commensurate, concomitant action thereafter, which I think is wholly lacking. And I think that's why we end up with repeat offenders that the AG's got to go visit every single year.
Thank you, Honourable Hari Odalas.
Thank you, Chief. Let me also apologize for arriving late. I was chairing a committee meeting. Now, I just want to comment on the issue of the application of this amendment act. Minority is effective from the 1st of April this year. But what happened in a situation where, let's say, the irregularity took place, say, the year before, but it has not yet been resolved. It is continuous. Let me make an example about the VPS matter, for example. It's a matter that has not yet been closed. Will that amendment be applicable to that situation? Thank you.
Question?
No. I'm fine, except to reiterate the fact that having listened to, I think, all members, they just want the Auditor General to then enter into a space where I feel that it's not covered with remedial action, then what happens? And the other issue that I also observed is that the members also would want to know, how do you then, what is your selection of projects? Because the problem, it's not just in one municipality or one local, but it's provincial government. But you may find that it is across the country. Do you have capacity to do that? Do you work with whistleblowers? What informs you going physically and trying to check for the project if it was really spent according to its specifications and the money allocated to the project?
Yeah, my comment would be, I think all of us were expected to have to be in other meetings at 2 o'clock, and considering your commitment also, we're supposed to finish at 2, and we have so many things that you want to address with you, very interesting subject, because I think this is the core. As a country, we have always been lacking in terms of consequence management. Identifying issues as per this amendment is going to highlight issues, but what are we doing at the end of the day? And I'm happy that at some stage you have mentioned the issue of the accounting officer and the executive authority. But overall, I think the concern or to us as the oversight body or public rights, what do we do about these things? Do we identify them, then talk about them in the media, and what are the consequences? At the end of the day, the actions that must be taken, you tried to highlight that. I think that's where our main concern is, and we appreciate the work that you're doing.
No, thank you very much, members, for the questions. Perhaps let me just cover the specific questions in broad strokes, and I was hoping that the chair was also intimating the need for a follow-up engagement at an appropriate time where we all have enough minutes to spend, and we will be more than happy to come back on our side. But let me start with the area questions. You know, if one looks at the situation that we have generally, it's a situation where you report to the people that have been presiding over the system, report to the people that have been supervising the systems of internal control to make sure that government money doesn't get spent in all ways that are not acceptable. Now, our historical experience, if you look at the audit outcomes over the years, you can take 15 years, you can take the longest period since the PFMA has been in place, since the MFMA has been in place. You will find in our analysis every year this whole issue of painting lack of consequence. Why? Because people start, when an audit starts, they know that whatever it is that you report is still going to be subjected to our control, and we may choose to do nothing about it, and nothing might happen. And therefore it grows over a number of years. Now let's look at what this situation provides. And I take the point the Honorable Member raised earlier, saying that the referral doesn't change anything. Well, for us, it has already changed people at the level of an accounting officer level, as we experience now. Now they are thinking twice now. They are no longer just leaving matters of the audit to juniors. They are now wanting to be in control of what's going on, so that there is no matter that slips through their hands which they would need to explain to. So the point being, when you know an audit is going to result in some consequence and you are an accounting officer, you better make sure that your environment is shaped in a way where you are not going to get surprises. A referral is not what we do currently. We don't refer anything because nothing has been given us the power to do that. But when you know that that particular development of the human settlement project in section 13 of your province or municipality, that whole project is going to be subject to an intensive investigation. And it doesn't have to wait for a whistleblower. The auditors will pick it up themselves as part of the statutory function every year. Then I think it will change many people who have been doing things without thinking. Closer to home here, I think it was in Oudtshoorn municipality. A municipal manager had to go to the High Court on a transaction or transactions that were falling foul of the legislation in respect of supply chain. When this person was found guilty on an expenditure of about 2 million and something for violating supply chain processes, their argument was that I was told by the mayor and the speaker to do it, and the court would have none of it, because the court would say, you as your accounting officer have all the necessary powers to do what is required. You don't have to tell us that this was imposed on you. Already there's a precedent in the court about how matters like this are handled as we speak now. But also the other one as well, in terms of the definitions on material irregularity. This is a tried and tested area. If you think about the accounts of Eskom in the private sector sense now, because they were audited by a private sector firm, those accounts for 2018 were delayed, if you recall, Honorable Member. Why? Because the private audit firm had submitted a reportable, they call it a reportable in the private sector, reportable irregularity on supply chain matters at Eskom. And it went to the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors. That's where private sector related reportable irregularities go. Ours remains in the system among the people who caused it as well as those that found it. So there are no loops that we need to go through to try and get to this. So material irregularity is understood, and I get the point about lawyers coming in and redefining the M of material and the I of irregularity. That's a different matter, but the reality is that in the context of financial control, in the context of playing a supervisory role over finances, as well as in the context of applying probity on finances, there's not too many gray areas as far as that is concerned, because some of these payments are quite visible where they went, and fortunately for us, it can either be a debit or a credit. There's no third option. It's either you declare it based on the accounting rules that apply, and we take the point that there will be lawyers who will take us on, but I think in terms of the inputs that we got as we were developing this from senior counsel, I think we're on firm ground as far as that is concerned. As far as the response and the risk and the capacity on the basis of selection, we have been doing these audits for the longest time as an institution. Even if I speak for those that are no longer around, I mean, this is an institution that has tested risk management in an audit for many, many decades. They may not have done it in the same way in 1911, because they were auditing railways and agricultural produce and all those type of things. And as things evolve over the industrial economy, we've developed risk intelligent ways of looking at something. So it's not necessarily dependent on whistleblowers, but it's dependent on the intelligence and the risk assessment of the auditors. Where if an entity has been allocated a, let's say, 1.5 billion of expenditure on infrastructure. As an auditor, you ought to know, when you are a conservative auditor, that there will possibly be many that settle around that environment, because there's now going to be procurement processes to spend this 1.5 billion. Unlike an entity that has got static assets where they are just, for example, a museum. A museum probably not very big budgets. They probably are tasked to maintain and control existing assets, a museum, versus an entity. So it's all dependent on the technical knowledge of the auditors, and we train them to be able to know that when you look at an invoice, for example, of an entity, you don't need a whistleblower to know that if that entity was given a 400 million contract, and when you go through the accounting records, you find that they've got a CNA invoice starting from page 1 to page 50. These are some of the learnings in forensics that we have picked up. An entity that has got an invoice like that and is invoicing a contract for 400 million starts raising tentacles to the auditors to ask, to what extent has an assessment of the administrative systems of this entity that won this contract been properly assessed by the entity that issued the contract? Because that indicates to one that the service provider went to buy a ready-made invoice from CNA. Where is their accounting system? Could they not be operating this business of theirs in the back of a car? These are some of the things that auditors are there to unpack, so we don't really have to get someone to come and whisper in our ears, because we understand over a cumulative period of time where the bulk of the problems could possibly be, but we also understand based on engagement that this finance officer is probably doing this job, controlling this huge budget, with competences far less than the minimum required. And that's based on, I'm listening to you explaining to me a particular transaction, and you start telling me about an asset register when I'm asking for an asset register. You know, then you're dropping hints to the auditors that you probably are controlling a huge budget. And if you're controlling a huge budget and your competences are less than what's required, then the people around you who are senior enough are going to run rings around you, because you don't understand what you are supposed to control. And this is what matters to them, that if I get someone who doesn't understand what they are doing, the chances are that they're not going to ask me any difficult questions, as an example. So it's all based on what can auditors do. And I think the reality here is that auditors, unlike other places where you must first blow the whistle or you must have a complaint, well, the Constitution has already complained, in essence, by saying that all entities publicly funded must be audited, which means that it's already identified the fact that there are risks of inappropriate financial management that need to be responded to. And best for people who have got that level of training. And they're not going to pick up everything, because the audit will focus on those material transactions, and it may not pick up others, that's fine. But the reality is that someone, once something has been picked up, would have to be answering to it, unlike in the past where there was no need for someone to be taken on some of these matters. Because we were always waiting for the good-heartedness of those accounting officers to come forth and respond to these matters. And guess what? Our experience is that it has not. So, Chair, let me just pause here. I know that there are a number of specific questions, but I try to cover quite a broad range of them. But just one point, perhaps, I want to make regarding the process before the certificate issue. That process has already been clearly defined in our regulations, and it will involve us having to set up an independent committee that will be made up of people outside of the employ of the AG, who at a minimum must possess legal training, who must possess financial stroke risk management knowledge, and other kind of expertise that we might be looking for, so that the accounting officer can then deposit their representations to that independent committee to say, this is what the Auditor General has picked up on my environment. I contest this because of ABCD. And that's where that whole process will be handled in terms of an independent evaluation of the decisions that we would have made. So we won't be involved. We will just be part of the people that go to that independent committee to answer any specific questions that they might have. So that's what will be triggered as part of these regulations that have now been put in place. As far as the prices in the CPO and the standardization of prices, when they set up the CPO office at the time when Kenneth Brown was in there, they had identified this as one of the projects that they will undertake as part of modernizing the supply chain processes. I can only say that it's still possibly work in progress. We haven't seen any finality on those matters. As well as the amended act, as far as the retrospective publication, if a particular irregularity is continuing, even after the 1st of April, it doesn't matter when it happens, the fact that it's continuing, it falls foul of these particular regulations. But the auditors are not required to go back to years prior 1 April. It's only when you've got, let's say, a five-year contract that was in implementation, let's say it was in year two by the time these amendments came into force, and you've got another 3 years of expenditure. If any of the expenditure that you've incurred in the period after 1 April falls foul of these regulations, then it doesn't matter when you entered it into, as long as the fact that you're making payments against it in the period where this act applies. But we don't have a requirement to go back with regards to
the historical items. Thank you. Good clock, members. 10 minutes past 2 o'clock. We are expected to be the house, the two houses that are plenary. And I think after you respond AG, you have triggered more questions. And I think there's that willing from the members to make follow-up questions, go for second bite. But I think the team for this committee will have to work around to make sure that we have another session with the AG. Because these sessions are the ones that are helping us and empowering us to do the work, and also as we do the laws, to do the laws that will allow these concerns that we're having to be attended to, and also to make your work easier. You are allowed to go, AG. Members, I think we are going to meet again for another item at 5 o'clock. Where is the venue? Same, all the time. All Assembly Chairman, we are going to meet there at 5 o'clock, and the meeting stands adjourned for now.